Okay, welcome everybody. This week we begin a new book of the Bible, the book of Vayikra, Leviticus, whatever that is. And the first bunch of Parshiot deal with the sacrificial system, which on the surface seems to be bizarre. And the title of the class is, Should the Sacrificial System Be Restored? Should it be restored? And, okay, we're going to get to that. But we're going to take our normal circuitous journey to that question, as we always like to do. So I'm going to begin with a video a conversation with two award-winning authors about food, Michael Pollan and Michael Moss. Michael Pollan wrote Omnivore's Delight. He wrote a number of interesting books. He did TED Talks. You'll Google him later, or when I'm talking, I won't even know. So let's watch a short video, and the title is Navigating the Supermarket. Here we go.
So here is the massive Himalayan Sierra. I mean, just kind of look at the sweep of this kind of real estate territory.
This is a cliff of sugar beet, by and large, right?
Yeah, with little passes in between where you can try to sort of navigate yourself to get to the more whole foods.
Americans spend about half as much time cooking as they did in the 1960s, relying more than ever on highly processed foods. The New York Times brought together noted food journalists Michael Moss and Michael Pollan.
Oh my God, we gotta get some of these.
To talk about home cooking, the food industry, and navigating a typical supermarket.
It seems like there's a tranquil atmosphere here, quiet, there's peaceful music, smells okay, but behind these shelves is the most fiercely competitive industry there is. They are all jockeying for position on the shelf. They're fighting each other for stomach share, that they call.
Both authors have recently published books. Michael Moss investigates the development and marketing of food products in salt, sugar, fat. And Michael Pollan rediscovers his own kitchen and cooked.
You know, a lot of people, when they hear this term processed food, assume it's all the same and it's all equally bad.
Right.
And it's actually not true. There are processed foods that are one or two or maybe three ingredient processed foods. And then there are these things we call ultra processed or hyper processed foods.
Lunchables, we have to
think about great products, right? We need to talk about this.
Oscar Mayer first came up with this idea because back in the 80s they were having trouble selling red meat. They put their geniuses together and they were actually marketing people with the way of repackaging their essential ingredients. So they started with the red meat and then added cheese when they merged with Kraft. They used crackers because they couldn't use bread. And then they came up with this great kind of school bus yellow motif for the package. By Kraft's own acknowledgement, it's not about the food as much as it is about the empowerment.
All day, you gotta do it. But lunchtime is all yours.
And look at the number of ingredients. This is a hyper-processed food.
How do you feel about frozen vegetables?
This again goes to that distinction between processed food and ultra-processed food. I think frozen vegetables are terrific, and I always have frozen spinach. And this is a really simple product. It's basically spinach. Here's a case where I would buy organic, but I don't think. And that's an important point. More important than you eat vegetables, even if they're conventional, I'm talking about your health, than it is that you wait till you can afford organic or you can find organic. This is a real convenience food that I think genuinely is a boon to mankind. So we'll get one of those. Okay, Stonyfield, low-fat, fruit on the bottom. This has 21 grams of sugar per 6 ounces.
So there is this
challenge. And this is organic, by the way. This is the illustration point you were making earlier. And this is probiotic. That's probiotic. That's another magic word.
Yeah.
But it has 26 grams of sugar. This has more sugar in it than Coca-Cola. So I once asked a yogurt manufacturer why you don't have the equivalent of honest tea for yogurt, like for adults who don't want. want to be swamped with sugar,
right,
or don't want to give their kids sugar.
Right.
And explain to me how the pressure, the arms race, to get more and more sugar in is irresistible. If your competitor has more sugar, they're going to sell more yogurt. You have to match them.
There's a company I ran into that put a ticker tape of this showing their stock price in the lobby so their employees could see it every morning when they came to work so they would know what was most important.
But they're playing, of course, with these very deep desires we have that we don't have that much control over.
Yeah.
And those are the levers that they're manipulating constantly.
All right.
We need to go to the fresh area.
Yep, all the way across the store. Hinterland.
All right. Okay. So that was interesting on a number of levels. It's going to ask you a series of questions. Here we go. What has modern agriculture and food production done to our eating experience? I mean, this is actually a book, but just give me some basic sense.
It has vastly increased options.
Yes. What else?
All you have to do is go to...
Say again?
Food is more processed than unhealthy.
Yeah, food is, well, yeah. Now, why is food more processed? He gave the reason. Why is food more processed and unhealthy?
Fewer people are cooking.
So, A, people are cooking, as they say, there's half the amount of time to cooking, so people need food on the go. That's one factor. And what he said, which is very interesting, which there's the economics of this. There's a tremendous competition for shelf space and stomach share, as they said. So what gets more shelf space and stomach share? Products that have what?
Things that are sweeter that people want more.
Sugar.
Or high fructose corn syrup, fructose, all the different words for sugar. Basically, there's sugar in everything. Tomato sauce, sugar. Ketchup, sugar. Yogurt, sugar. Everything that you think doesn't have sugar, it has sugar.
Peanut butter.
Now, why is that? He alluded to that as well. That was the last line that Michael Pollan mentioned. Suzanne, why?
Economics and money.
Why? So show me the correlation. Show me the cause and the effect.
People sugar. Want things that are sweeter.
Well, sugar, there's an addictive quality to sugar. It's highly addictive.
There you go. It's, in other words, the more things that have sugar you eat, the more it actually develops your desire for things sweet and more sugar. In other words, sugar begets sugar, which of course begets weight. That's why that is a major reason, according to many, why 70% of Americans are overweight by 30 pounds, i.e. being technically obese. Okay, that's the reason of sugar. Okay, there's a whole series about sugar. That's a generic point. So there is the goal is to sell as much amount of the person needs about between 2,000 2,500 calories. Do you know how many calories America's food producers produce per year, per person, per day, on average? Like close to 3,800 calories per person, per day, in the United States. So what's the problem?
Well, they're expecting to sell that amount, and so somebody somewhere is they have some, I guess, math that indicates to them that somebody somewhere is... consuming that amount of calories.
Right, so they need us to buy their calories and have the other producer not buy it. So therefore, that's why you can have more sugar in a 6-ounce yogurt, even organic, Stonyfield, right? Because the Stonyfield people need to watch out from the,
Yoplait
people who are watching out for the Yoplait people, who's watching out for the Dannon people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, they keep adding more and more and more sugar because the more sugar you put in something, invariably, obviously it's not as simple as this, but you'll sell more. Okay. So that's pushing the process. Let's go on to, I'm giving a sort of a general point. I recommend the Omnivore's Dilemma. There are a lot of good books out there on this topic. It's a well-discussed topic. Number two, what is Oscar Mayer Lunchables? Highly effective at disguising.
That there's no real ingredients in it.
They don't disguise that. What are they really trying to disguise? When are they had a problem?
Where your food comes from?
But they were losing mark. What were they losing mark? What is Oscar? Let me start. What does Oscar Mayer produce?
Highly processed foods.
What kind of foods?
Meat.
Convenience foods.
Meat. Oscar Mayer is one of the leading producers of hot dogs and cold cuts and etc. Processed meat. Okay, and what was happening? People did not want to eat red meat, highly processed, meat. So they were losing market share. So what did they do?
They partnered with Kraft and added cheese to it, and then they added crackers to it.
But the marketing. What was the marketing genius?
The marketing genius was to children to disguise the highly processed food as something that was comforting and something that they wanted, and it had this school bus yellow motif.
Right, and it was empowering to the kids. You guys know you're not going to eat that crummy school food. You're going to have this,
wholesome,
this independent, powerful food, which you can eat if you're a student. You're not going to be bossed around by adults with meat. You're going to have the food that you want. Bottom line, but it's still terrible. You know, it's basically it's highly processed third-rate meat with highly processed, cheese product with highly processed cracker product put in a nice little box.
But that box, that's a beautiful box.
It is a beautiful box, okay? And plus they... entire marketing campaign to kids during on kid channels on cable and during when kids watch cartoons and kids things. Okay, here, all right, now we're honing in on it. Okay, question number three, why do we love the world of disguised foods? We all love disguised foods.
Because we can pretend that the food may be healthy for us. We can pretend that the food is good for us when it's really not.
There you go.
We need to do that.
Okay, number one. In other words, for example, on the yogurt, they put it. This is not just regular yogurt. This is probiotic, which will allow your gastrointestinal. Your GI system to better assimilate the food. Meanwhile, it's a truckload of sugar. We're going to put low fat, which also means high sugar. We're going to put high in fiber, high sugar. We're going to put, now what do they do about the meat?
They put free range, which is a big lie.
All right, so they put free range. Now, but what about, let's talk about, you go into the meat aisle of any supermarket. What is disguised about that?
They hide the intense cruelty and horror that's inherent in the slaughtering of animals.
Well, you don't even feel they're animals.
Right. They're entirely detached from a natural existing thing.
Right. That, in other words, how good is it? It basically there's live animals, there's the slaughtering of animals, there's the eating of formerly alive beings. You go into a supermarket, you don't feel that at all. You have this white plastic tray, styrofoam tray, with a saran wrap over it. Everything is perfectly red, and with a little, things like, it says,
USDA choice, black
choice, prime beef, ingot, right. So, but you don't really feel at all that you're eating a formerly living creature. at all. And what the Oscar Mayer did was, you don't even think you're even eating meat. You're having a Lunchable, whatever a Lunchable is.
Yeah, it takes your separation from where that food comes from even one step further away.
Correct. It's completely divorced. Well, that's why the whole farm-to-table movement was to try to undo this fantasy, okay? We'll talk about this. We're going to get to this. There's a lot to talk about. We only have an hour, but we also want to get into the partial. Now, I want to go into the psychological area, okay? What is the difference between sublimation of an instinct and repression of an instinct? Sublimation versus repression. Suzanne?
If so, you're making it somehow in your mind okay.
Which one is that?
Sublimation.
Okay.
To eat this.
We're not limiting it to the issue of me. We're talking about in general. Sublimation.
Or an instinct. So, and people do this all the time. Like, they'll justify something that they know is not right, but.
That's rationalizing. That is ascribing a false cause to an activity, right? Mm-hmm. So I might lie to myself that right. I eat this cookie. You know, for example, I feel stressed. Therefore, I'll eat this bag of cookies. Okay, because not so bad. Because I deserve to be less stressed. So that's a rationalization. Because now instead of having one problem called stress, now I have three problems. I have the original stress. I feel bad about myself because I am eating copious amounts of cookies. And I have a third problem. Now I have a larger waistline. I now have three problems. Okay? That's not sublimation. What is sublimation?
To put it in a more appropriate looking?
To put it in a more appropriate or positive way. For example, sublimation of an instinct. For example, let's say I have violent tendency. Okay? So what I'm going to do, I might sublimate, direct that to be a surgeon. So as a surgeon, I cut open people's flesh, but for the purpose of removing tumors and providing health and well-being. So I'm directing that aggressive instinct in a positive way. I am aggressive, so I might become work in law enforcement. So I might, yes, I'm aggressive, but I'm using to help enforce law and order. That's sublimation. Okay? Or I have a lot of energy. So I'm now going to spend some extra time working out. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to direct the energy, the pool of energy, into a positive goal, to health and well-being. Okay, what is repression of an instinct?
People are like white-knuckling it. They're trying not to act on an instinct.
Right, they are pushing it down. They are.
It's kind of like denial, no?
It is not like denial. It is, you're denying your instinct. You're putting it, you're not fully aware, conscious of the reality of the desires I have. Okay? I'm denying it. Denial. So make it very simple. Sublimationing is directing it for a positive benefit. That's repression of the sublimation. And repression is the denial of the instinct. Okay. These are the two psychological concepts we need to move forward. Everybody good with that? Is that clear to everybody? Sublimation is directing an instinct of man to a positive, healthy goal or ideal. Repression of an ideal is a denying of the existence that I even have that instinct at all. Is that clear? Okay. Now, let's move on in. What instincts are involved in meat production? I spared you by showing a video. I don't want anybody to projectile vomit of industrialized slaughterhouses. Okay? I had a little Rachmanis to Suzanne and everybody else, not just Suzanne, everybody. Okay? What instincts are involved in meat production?
Kindness. I'm just kidding. Aggression. It's clearly aggression.
So what are you doing with an animal? This is a living being, and I'm killing it. Okay? And I may even, you know, unfortunately, there's a thing called, in Judaism, called Tsar Baalei Chaim. There's a prohibition of causing unnecessary pain to animals. Okay? You'll have that. Unfortunately, in many in the non-Jewish, and even I don't even know, maybe in the Jewish as well, where they're, you know, feeding these animals, you know, a diet so they fatten up, and then they're putting in they're in a very closed quarters because they got to ship them, move them, and then there's the slaughtering of the animals, and then there's the chopping them up into their appropriate parts for sale, essentially. Okay, and So it's a very, by definition, it's a very aggressive activity, by definition. You're killing a creature, and now, we're going to get to this, you know, all right, so is that clear? Would you agree that those instincts are necessary for the killing of animals? I mean, right?
Aggression?
Yeah, so the violent, aggressive, yes.
I don't know. I think that's a conversation that can be had. I think that, you know,
in other words, for Jewish law, so, you know, for example, a shochet to the knife they use. I know a guy who does it. He's not a professional, but when he does chita, he has to spend a half an hour sharpening his knife to make it that it's absolutely nick-free, razor-free, so the process of shechita is as painless as possible. Okay, not true in regular American production. So, but still, to whatever you're going to say, to take a knife and slit a throat of a creature is an aggressive act. You are ending the life of the animal, okay? Is that clear? I mean, that's pretty much what's happening. We don't see it. We just go to a restaurant, and we go to Amsterdam Burger and have a nice burger. We're not thinking about the cow that gave its life for date night on a Thursday night. You know what I'm saying? All right.
His life was taken, right? He didn't give his life.
Right. He didn't offer his life. His life was taken. Correct. Okay. Clear? I'm just establishing that. I just want to establish it as a fact. The act of slaughtering requires a gesture of aggression. I'm not calling it murder. I'm calling it, you know, to end another creature's life. Yes or no?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's why that's why most people, I don't think, can do this activity, even if they are meat eaters. In fact, many people who have gone to a slaughterhouse or seen even on a farm, you know, where it's not done in a mass production way, they come in their meat eater
and
leave their vegetarians. Okay? That has happened. Okay, let's go on. Now, what explains, this is my question to you all, what explains the raucous excitement of the boxing knockout, the quarterback sack, and 250 million owners of copies of Call of Duty? How do you explain that phenomenon? Let's take it piece by piece. Many of you, certainly the guys, if you go on to cable TV, you'll pass through, there's a series of, let's say, boxing channels, right? Or MMA, mixed martial arts. When does the excitement of the crowd the most? What is the peak moment of excitement? Shmuel, when is the peak moment of excitement in a boxing match or a mixed martials match?
I would think that when you get to witness another person's, let's say for the sake of this conversation, killer instinct overcome or outwit someone else's, I don't know, I guess it's very thrilling.
Right, so it's the act of the knockout. Or a person down to the mat. You will
pretend like you're not watching MMA all the time.
I do like boxing. No, I'm not speaking about anybody other than I'm including in this. I'll say it in the first person. When I watch a boxing match or MMA or NFL football, the excitement that animate everybody who's watching it is at the moments of the most harsh contact. Either the boxer is knocked out, the MMA fighter gets a leg to the face and is knocked down and bleeding, gets a big crowd, big response, or a big 350-pound lineman gets through the defenseman line and goes and crushes the and slams the quarterback to the ground so hard that his helmet pops off and the crowd goes wild. Yes or no? I'm not the only one watching this. It wasn't just one. I wasn't the only guy watching. Okay. True or not true?
True.
Now, very true.
When you watch people play Call of Duty, how many people will they shoot in 10 minutes?
A lot.
A lot.
I don't know.
So what trend or what instinct must you say is present?
The aggressive instinct. Or the violent, fantasy. The fantasy instinct, really.
Instinct of man. Now, do people feel that? Like, oh, let's have an opportunity to vicariously express our violent tendencies tonight, and let's go to the boxing match. Do people visualize like that?
No.
So is it more of a sublimation or more of a repression?
It's a sublimation.
Are they? So, yes, it is better than they themselves not stabbing people. That's true. That's an improvement. But are they aware of their aggressive, violent tendencies?
Is sublimation always is always an awareness of the instinct?
No.
So
sublimating is that I'm putting my desire, my instinct in a positive for a positive outcome. You could sublimate, but I'm just is in a certain sense that is a sublimating. It is a sublimating watching that. But are they aware of their instinct at all?
No, no.
No.
People, I mean, maybe. It's to varying degrees.
Okay, I'm not going to say, obviously, we're talking about all of humanity. By and large, I mean, I don't think about it. Like, oh, let me vent my aggressive desires by watching, linemen crush quarterbacks, onto the stadium floor.
I mean, I agree. It's subconscious, but, I mean, a lot of people at, for example, in my office, a lot of people will deal with the stress of the job by going home and playing literally Call of Duty or some other first-person shooter game for hours on end, in the evenings to literally what they say is to blow off steam, which is another way of saying I feel really aggressive or frustrated. I'm going to go home and vent my anger and frustration in this way.
It is a sublimation. In other words, the instinct is getting satisfaction through another means versus direct aggression. So that is a sublimation. That's good. But the level of awareness, or they could both sublimate it, and they could the instinct is being repressed. They're not aware of this.
Well, I would say, I guess, I hear what you're saying. It seems like they might be repressing the instinct in that they're not actually directly dealing with it.
Correct.
They've just continued to play the stupid video game.
Right. So they have a video and digital way to express that instinct, but they're not being aware. They're not really exploring, well, why, if I'm upset at my job, does shooting people in the head in Call of Duty 1, 2, 3, World War 1, World War 2, or 3, whatever the, you know, yeah. Special ops, whatever the, there's 20 versions already.
Like 17 of them. It's ridiculous.
Right. But they're not, it's not ridiculous because they've sold 250 million. I looked it up on Wikipedia. You know, I was blown away. I didn't expect that. So that's, there are three, just to give you a sense, there are 330 million citizens in the United States of America. 330 million. Worldwide, quarter billion people have bought Call of Duty. A version of Call of Duty.
Worldwide, though. Worldwide.
I'm hearing that. Okay, now. So, I just want to establish that the aggressive, violent, driving man is alive and well. Is that clear? And in a certain sense, you know, we're surprised when people go and shoot people. But we really shouldn't be. You know what I'm saying? Because there should be more shootings. Because, you know, people are not so good at sublimating these violent desires. You know what I'm saying? I would argue the other way. It's a relatively low amount. All right. Now, let's pivot. What is the moral question concerning slaughtering and consuming meat? What is the question? In a sentence, it's a very simple question.
Suzanne?
Are you contributing to suffering when you consume meat?
But let's go one more prior, let's go one principle, let's go to even more basic assumption. Let's go a step more broad.
Where do you get the, if you're going to say, if you can justify killing the animal on one basic principle, if you're going to say that the right goes to who it might makes right. If that's the only principle under which you're operating under, then fine. Then you're pretty much going.
But you're already answering. You're already pausing a position. Let's go to one level more broad.
What gives you the right to do it in the first place?
Why would you think you not have a right?
Why do you think you would not have the right? Because it doesn't belong to you.
Well, let's say you own it.
Huh?
People are generally not slaughtering animals they don't own. The issue is not the ownership issue.
It's still taking another life.
Right, that's it. Do I have the right to kill another living being?
Okay.
That's the question. You're already giving us a reason. Well, if you assume might makes right, okay? So that's the, you understand, that's the whole question. That is the question. Now, so I'm going to give you some of the, I'm just going to share a little bit of the perspective here. If you go on to the PETA website, who are the, let's call it anti-meat.
Animal rights propagandists.
Right. So they're the most extreme militant thing because they have one assumption. They're fundamentally saying that man and animal are no different. The animal is an animal, and we too are animals. Just as we don't kill people, we have no right to kill animals. And therefore, and based upon that assumption, right, they refer to, you know, they call it the Holocaust on your plate. Because they view animal, because, you know, based upon that assumption, the meat manufacturing or the industrial meat industry of the world is basically a worldwide genocide. And if you take that assumption,
genocide is kind of a harsh term.
One second. If you take that first assumption that man is an animal and the animals are an animal, and we take the assumption we don't have a right to kill people, right? So what right do you have to keep an animal? No thing. If you make that equation, they're 100% correct. So really, a slaughterhouse is a concentration camp. Just saying, if you take that assumption, they're correct. Okay, we're trying to be logical here, not emotional. Is that true or not true?
I think something.
You're gathering the animals on cattle cars. We call them cattle cars. You're centralizing into a small area so you can use machinery to butcher them for human consumption and other use. Yes or no?
Great. Now I'm vegan.
Okay. Do you see how that follows from that first principle?
Look, the same logic can be applied to slaughtering soybeans and making tofu.
What would the Torah argue with that assumption? What premise does the Torah argue with PETA?
That man's aggressive instinct can be sublimated and the slaughter of animals can be done in an appropriate way versus inappropriate way.
No, they don't have a problem with. First of all, that's a secondary issue. One is they have a problem intrinsically that you have no right to slaughter animals at all, period. And on top of that, and you're not only doing it, you're doing it in a most brutal fashion. And not only that, you're ruining the environment. And not only that, you know, they have other arguments. But I'm starting from the first principle, okay? The first principle is that the act of killing animals is unjust. So how would the Torah respond to PETA? What assumption, we're lasering in, what assumption would the Torah argue with the PETA people?
Well, human beings.
But the purpose of animals is to serve man?
Well, that's already a secondary, that's an application. That's a secondary principle. What's the first principle?
Man is on a higher level than animals to begin with?
Man is not an animal. In other words, man is not a sophisticated animal. Man is a qualitatively different thing. All right? And as such, the way that the Torah depicts it in chapter 1, the animal kingdom. Interesting enough that God did not allow Adam to even only be vegetarian. Was maybe even vegan. Not clear.
He was pescatarian. Let's just settle on pescatarian.
No, could not fish. No fish either. Who got the right to eat animals?
Noah.
Noah is correct after the flood. Now the question is, why was that allowed? That's a sheer in its own right.
That's my brother, by the way.
What? There you go. So the key word here I want to focus upon is that really it's a halacha of a heter. What does the word heter mean? The Hebrew word heter.
Kindness.
What? Repeat that, Sean.
Wait, was the question what the hesed?
No, what does the word heter mean?
Oh.
What?
An exemption?
Yeah, an exemption or a permission. In other words, it's not that you can eat meat. They were given a dispensation for meat. Okay? In fact, when the Jews were in the there was a time when the Jews were in the desert in the 40 years, the debate in the Talmud, were the Jews allowed to eat meat if it wasn't functioning as an offering? So according to one of the Tanaim, a Jew could only have meat if it was part of an offering. He could not make a personal barbecue. He wasn't allowed. Could not kill the animal. Okay? So the attitude of Judaism is there's a general principle called Baal Tashin, and you cannot waste. Even you can't even cut down trees. We learn Baal Tashkent, you cannot waste the resources of God's world from the case of war. You're not allowed to, in order to build up a rampart to be able to attack the city, cut down fruit trees. Okay? You can't, you only have non-fruit trees. You're wasting the, you're killing, you're unnecessary, not just the animals, even the fruit-bearing trees. So the attitude is, has to be that we have to relate to the resources of the world as it has to be, has to serve a higher purpose. So let's take, for example, a classic question. What would Judaism say about animal testing? Using mice or rabbits to inject them with cancer, A, and then inject them with cancer-saving drugs to determine what drug would be effective for humans to live. Good or no?
There's animal testing, and then there's animal testing.
Okay, I'm not saying, you know, but let's say, let's just add the caveat to keep it somewhat clean. It's done in the most, best, humane way possible. But again, you can't just inject people with, very intense, harsh, chemotherapy drugs and say, well, let's see if it works. Oh, the guy died, So they have the FDA and the CDC will have a test done on animals first. Does Judaism view that as moral or not moral?
I mean, I think Judaism views the prison population as the folks to do that with.
No. No, I cannot do that. No, definitely not. But animals, yes. You're using the animal for a higher purpose, which is the preservation of the wealth and well-being of people. People are on a existentially higher level. But you just can't just inject an animal with cancer because you have a sadistic desire. You can't do that.
Well, would you make a distinction between things like drug testing for something like curing cancer versus, I know this is an easy one to pick, so forgive me, but it's like experimenting with makeup.
That's a very that's a legit question. That would be a legit halakhic question because that's not really. Yeah, that's I'm gonna.
Cosmetic
right,
testing.
Right. So that's a good example. There, it's not really. Is that viewed as a true human need that the woman has to find the makeup or that thing, that cosmetic that will last longer or have a better whatever the outcome? That's very, I would say, very questionable. I'll leave it like that. I don't know that much about it. I'm going to leave that. But that's, I'm just getting to the point. We only have 15, 20 minutes left. Let me keep on going here. There's a key pasuk in Mishle, Yodea Tzadik Nefesh Behemto, Barakamei Roshan Machzari, which means a righteous man knows the needs of his beast, but the compassion of the wicked is cruelty. Now, what is the double entendre, a word that means two things in this verse? Find the word that could be read or learnt in two ways.
I feel like it could be beast.
Beast is correct.
Yeah, I was going to say beast or compassion.
Nope, beast is correct. Now, what are the two possibilities? How could you read the word beast in two senses? What could be referred to? Give me two possibilities what the word beast could be referring to.
The beast inside one's self.
That's one. That's right. That's one possibility. Or literally the animal himself. No, either an extraneous animal, his pet or his animals, or the animal that is part of him. Now, why does Proverbs?
Are you reading this as the righteous man, when a righteous man knows the needs of his beast? Are you reading that to mean that the righteous man knows the needs of the beast that he's going to slaughter or something? Or are you talking about the righteous man knows the needs of his beast, meaning his instinctual self?
Yes, either the two, either his instinctual self, the animal, let's call it the animal part of him, A, or B, literally his animal, which is his pet or his livestock. Okay, now what? So why is Mishle praising that? Why is the why is it the mark of a righteous person that they know the needs of the beast, which the beast within? Yushmuel's phrase. Why is it a mark of righteousness?
Because that's the mark of the man who has overcome that part of him.
Well, that doesn't overcome. Another, yeah. Why? Tell me the correlation. How does one thing apply to the other?
That's the mark of the man who has sublimated the instinctual side of him, as opposed to the man who gives in, who has compassion, so to speak, for the instinctual side of himself, but it's actually cruelty.
So in other words, in order to step away from the rat race of unconsciously sublimating or unconsciously repressing or acting out any of the three options, is to become aware of these internal forces. In other words, there's a huge instinctual world which is within us, which is nefesh behemto, which they call the way that the Chazal referred to called the nefesh bahami, the instinctual, the animal soul of man, the instinctual side of man. You know what I'm saying? Which we're talking about violence and aggression is certainly an instinctual part of man. Okay, the righteous person is whose soul directs the animal part of himself. Is the commander of the ship, if you will. Okay, not being commanded by the desires. Okay, now, how does it apply, going back to slaughtering and eating of meat? What's happening today in our situation? You go to the supermarket, you go to a restaurant, what's happening?
There's all kinds of choice. There's a complete disguising of the source of this food that's on your plate. It's totally divorced from any sort of process. You have an incredible amount of selection of giant portions of meat that can be put on your plate in an instant, that's cooked to your liking and prepared in any way you wish. Yes. And there's no sense of reality as far as where it came from.
Right. There's no sense that this animal gave up, did not, you know, life was taken up for you to have this food entertainment.
Right, entertainment, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
It's basically food entertainment. For, you know, in other words, the fast food, the billions and billions of hamburgers sold by McDonald's basically has been, you know, it's basically food entertainment. You know what I mean?
But at least, look, at least they turned the M upside down to a W on Women's Day.
There you go. Exactly. Now.
They made up for it.
Now, with this background, I'm now going to be able to, I'm going to understand, we've got a little minute here. All right, so we're only 8 minutes left, so I'm going to fast forward. The beginning of the book of Vayikra says, Hashem tells Moshe, speak to Bnei Israel, and one brings a mammal as an offering to God to sacrifice and be taken from the cattle, sheep, or goats. If it's a burnt offering, it should be unblemished. You bring it, own free will, and you put your hands on the head of the burnt offering. It's accepted as an atonement, okay? It's an atonement in some way or another. You should have the young bull slaughtered before God. Aaron's sons, its priests, will bring forth blood, dashing, throwing it on the altar. And then it's skinned, it's cut up, it's put on the fire, okay? So it seems, which it seems on the surface, a very violent activity. What's the point of this? Okay, so we're gonna get into the Ramban's take on the Ramban's take here. Okay, so I got a couple minutes here. So let's have Sean read it out.
All right. Ramban cites an alternative explanation of the sacrifices, which he finds more acceptable. and it is more fitting to heed the rational that they say concerning sacrifices, that since the actions of humans are consummated through thought, speech, and action, God commanded that when a person sins, he shall bring an offering. He shall lean his hands on it, corresponding to the action component of his sin, and confess his sin with his mouth, corresponding to the speech component, and burn the innards and the kidneys, which are the organs of thought and desire, in the fire of the altar, corresponding to the thought component. And the legs of a burnt offering are also burned, corresponding to the person's hands and feet, which do all his work for him. And Hashem commanded further that he shall sprinkle the blood on the altar, corresponding to the blood of his soul. All of this is intended so that the person should contemplate while he is doing all these things that he has sinned to his God with his body and with his soul, and that it would have been appropriate that his own blood be spilled out and his own body be burnt, if not for the grace of Hashem, who has taken a substitute and a ransom for him in his place, that is, the sacrifice, allowing that his blood should be instead of his blood, a life for a life, and the extremities of the limbs of the offering corresponding to the extremities of his own limbs. And the priestly portions of the sacrifices shall be to provide for the teachers of the Torah, so that they may pray for him. And the reason for the daily offering is for public atonement, because the public as a whole cannot avoid sinning constantly. Now, these words are appealing. They draw one's heart like words of Agadah.
Okay, I got down to one word. What is the psychological term that best describes the korban, the sacrifice experience? One word that we use in psychology today. I got down to one word. What is the korban experience? So as the way that the Ramban depicts it, of the person who comes to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple, he's done a sin, and he has to take the little the cow, the sheep, the goat, put his hands on it. He has to verbalize the vidui, which we say on Yom Kippur, the confessional. He sees the animal being slaughtered, the blood is gathered, sprinkled, sliced up, burnt. What really is happening psychologically? What is he supposed to contemplate? What do we call this experience in one word?
Projection.
What?
Projection.
What do you mean by projection?
That the person is projecting his own sins onto the animal, giving the animal the things he did wrong, and the animal then is being sacrificed to take the sin away from the man.
But that's superstition. The animal did not, you can't transfer your sins. The sins are the imperfection of your soul. You can't transfer it on the animal. And also the guy has done, has already done tshuva. He's returned. He's now doing the last step with his vidui. What is the korban added? The one word answer. We got 4 minutes left. I'm going to tell you. Essentially, the korban experience, as understood by the Ramban, is what we call in modern day psychology and addiction therapy, it's an intervention. In other words, if you see a cow, a sheep.
An intervention?
An intervention. I'm going to explain that. Well, first of all, I'll explain what intervention is also. When we see a little cute 1-year-old perfect animal, like our pets, we feel a tremendous identification with it, okay? It's hard to understand that. I mean, hard to not feel connected to it. So to dramatize the impact of the experience, you have to put your hands on the head of this cute animal, which may have grown up on your farm or you may have bought it, one of the two. You verbalize the hate that you have done, and then you watch it being slaughtered. And then you watch the skin be taken off. And you watch it being washed and then put onto the Mizbeach. Okay? What is that really saying? Really, it's saying that really should be you. But God's cutting you a slack, allowing you to live another day. Because fundamentally, as a person, as an individual, and as a community, we have lost our way. So in other words, in America, we are being hidden from the intensity of the experience of slaughtering. No, the church says, no, you need to see this. Because it's an experience that you have it's there to wake up the person, not allow the person to be asleep. It's a massive wake-up call. An intervention is like this. Let's say you have a person who has a drinking problem. An intervention is that all their friends will take the person into the room and say, Joe, you have a problem. You're an alcoholic. I know you think you can handle it. Your life is falling apart. No, it's not true. What do you mean? I'd like to have fun like you guys do, you know. And they basically, every way that the person tries to defend themselves to keep up that illusion, break it down. Essentially, the Korban experience is meant to be intense. That the intensity of the slaughtering, of taking the creature, is not just you should have, you know, an entertainment on your plate. Okay? Rather, it's there to utilize for a sacred purpose. In other words, for a person to confront the defects of his life and to recognize that really that I'm off mission. And if I was really conscious of what's happening, I really should have the same destiny of this animal. So the fact that we're so far off from slaughtering animals actually is a negative, because therefore we take it for granted, and therefore we treat it in a cavalier way. No. If the person's having meat for health, if the person's having meat for enjoying a Shabbos and a Yontif, okay, that's a prior purpose. And certainly, which used to be for a certain time, that it was only used if it was going to be used as a therapeutic intervention experience in the temple, which, by the way, is very dramatic. If you're putting your hands there and you're part of the Kohanim and it's in the temple and you've had to go to the mikveh to be there, and you're saying and you're verbalizing your vidui, your confession on the animal, and then you see this happening, you're not, it, by design, you're not going to take that as being an insignificant light action. You know what I'm saying? So it's just instead of it being hidden from us, it's a value to understand the appreciating the enormity of taking an animal's life, and it should not be done lightly, but used as a wake up call to a person. You know what I'm saying?
They seem like very opposite ends of a process. An intervention seems like the beginning of a tshuva process, but the sacrifice seems like the end of the tshuva process after you've done tshuva.
So it's interesting. So you're saying that really that I can't, I'm not allowed to verbalize it until I've done some tshuva, but apparently maybe the word intervention is not good, because you're right. Intervention is at the beginning. Let's call to allow that intervention to be fully impacted in your psyche. To allow that intervention to, you know, the tshuva and the intervention to last. In other words, the general principle here is that the Torah never wastes a teachable moment. For example, a person's relative dies. The goal of mourning is one part therapeutic, but primarily it's spiritual, which means the goal is really to see the finality of life and to do tshuva, not waste your time. Because it's not like that relative is part of the dead club and I'll never be in the dead club. No, we're all going to die, and it might be tomorrow. So don't waste your life, because it's going to end, and it's always going to be sooner than you think. So the goal of Avelus, mourning, is to capture that sense, that teachable moment of the finality of life, and not to waste time, and to see what's important in life, and what are my priorities, and how should I move toward that. What the Ramban says, the same thing, is that since a person has actions of thought, speech, and action, the Torah is trying to dramatize, make that tshuva process not be superficial, but go deep. And the pattern, in other words, the power of slaughtering an animal that you have this connection with, makes that moment unforgettable. And in fact, the fact that we have, are consuming meat at a rate that never existed in all of human history is bad in the sense that we don't really, we've taken for granted the loss of life. And we don't, and you just can't just kill the animals for no, it has to be for a legit purpose. This is the highest purpose of killing an animal, a spiritual purpose. The next level is to help the health and well-being of mankind, let's say for medical purposes. Third is to celebrate on the holidays, okay? Fourth would be just to maintain a healthy diet, which, of course, the healthy diet now is that you have meat very infrequently. Essentially, you're going to have a plant diet, and like the Asians, you have meat in there just to add a little flavor, but it's not, you want to eat essentially grains and plants, and meat, if you're going to have it, done as essentially as a functioning as a sort of a secondary component. That's the current common wisdom. Okay.
Suzanne just chatted me. She said she wants a T-bone steak.
No, I don't think I know that she did not do that. So that's the deal. So that's the basic principle. In other words, in fact, what the awareness that man realized that it's the fact that the uncontrolled part of him, the animal within him, that the animal which he's putting his hands on is really the cause of his demise. And he has to recognize, because he never directed it properly, it ended up bad. Hold on 30 seconds here, guys. Hold on. Okay, so that's your key point. The purpose of going back to the first question, should the sacrificial be reinstated? Yes, because quite frankly, if seen in this light, instead of ignoring the reality and the brutality of animal slaughter and done generally oftentimes in a improper fashion, here. Animal slaughter, the enormity of that is being utilized for a breakthrough moment. That is the ideal. In fact, it used to be that was the only way you could have meat. If it was going to be associated with a spiritual and psychological breakthrough. Okay? Versus if you walk through New York City where there's 29,000 restaurants, most of them serving meat, shall we say, meat has been reduced to basically food entertainment at great cost of our collective human health, as is pointed out by many, at great cost of our environment because of the amount of fuel and carbon footprint and resource that are due to be able to feed and produce the corn and the cows to create such a endless flow of animals. There's a problem there. Again, the Torah whole does not take either extreme. Not that never have meat, but to the meat has to be dedicated for some higher purpose. The highest purpose is the korban, which is a spiritual, psychological breakthrough. A. The next level will be tikkun olam, to utilize animals again properly, not in a painful way, for breakthroughs in real medical research. Third is proper celebration of Shabbat and Yom Tov, which again is a spiritual purpose. And fourth is for health purpose, you know, to have a healthy body. But the person's just, you know, meat becomes a way to create that every day is a celebration, that makes nothing a celebration. That's the Ram calls that the eating of the wicked. And unfortunately, that really is American America. All right, but, you know, so I'm just giving you away. We eat meat, it has to be for a purpose, because you're not allowed to just take another creature's life for no purpose. It has to be for a higher purpose, okay? So what the korban really is utilizing the enormity and the psychological impact and even the brutality of a slaughter, which is you're not going to forget that, for, as he expresses, for a to make the tshuva breakthrough fully incorporated in the psyche of man. That's the Ramban's idea. Oh, that's the basic theory. Questions?
In terms of the sacrificial system,
yes.
The closest thing we have to that today, like before Yom Kippur, like the chicken thing, I forget the exact name of that. But.
Right. So there's an Oscar that's called literally called Kaparot, which is called literally means atonement. So you should know this was a hot debate. The author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, holds that's a Amorite practice. Because now there's no temple. What are you doing? And you're swinging an animal around, saying that the sins apply to that. That's a distortion. So again, if it, you know, the Ashkenaz custom would be viewed as being, again, you're recognizing the same idea of the Ramban, that really, if I had to pay for my sin account in a full way, I should have the same destiny as this chicken. In other words, it was a way that the Ashkenazi community developed as a way to recognize the enormity of my spiritual self, because our natural tendency is to say, I am awesome, period. And I only need a few touch-ups. But so that's where they created this custom to sort of break down that illusion. That's the principle. But there was, question is, it's very close to, as the Shulchan Aruch says, as a dark Amori. And then there's a third issue nowadays, because there's many people push back that people do in a way that might be harmful to the chicken. You're not allowed to call it called tzar. So therefore, you're trying to make your Yom Kippur better. Meanwhile, you're going to hurt the animal, which is a prohibition of tzar balei chayim. You can't cause unnecessary pain to an animal. So that's, I'm just seeing some of the issues.
Okay.
Questions, comments?
Just on what Ramban was talking about, it doesn't look like this is a korban that the person partakes of. Is this a korban that is completely consumed in fire?
Yes. Korban Ola.
Okay.
Oh, he also refers to it, some of them that the Kohanim get to eat some of it, the korban chatas, which he doesn't eat, but the animal. So he's saying that supporting, because the Kohanim were the educated people of the Jewish community. They were educated. So he says something very interesting, which I'm not going to. So says the priest portion that should be provided for the teachers of Torah, that's the Kohanim, so they may pray for him. It's interesting. All right, I don't want to go through each line as Ramban can be dissected. I just want to get the grand motif, because let me just, I'll conclude in these 30 seconds. When people think of a sacrifice, they say, well, that's a primitive, crazy thing.
Right.
But then what we've done basically show that really the reason why you think it's crazy is because basically the industrial food slaughtering industry has basically made hidden this whole very intense activity away from our eyes. So we don't really see it. We have these nice little, sanitized package of meat yumminess. We don't see that basically an animal is killed so you could have a steak. Okay. Now I'm not saying it's intrinsically. I'm trying to contact that we need the key principle here is that the eating using of any resource, and certainly of animal, killing animal, has to be for a higher purpose. The highest purpose is the korban, because it's actually coming in contact with the slaughtering and the intensity of that and the trauma of that, if you will, and the brutality of that will give the person the necessary wake-up call he or she needs. You know what I'm saying? It's utilizing the brutality. In other words, hiding the brutality is repression. This is confronting the brutality and trying to deal with that. Okay? And if you saw that, you might, you'd be more, we'd be more sensitive to the use of, just for animals, killing of animals. You know what I'm saying?
Thank you.
All right, guys, clear? All right, good.
Clear.
All right, guys, have a good night.
Good night. Thank you.
You got it. You're welcome.